This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio, 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean County and Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.1 in Lincoln, 89.1 in DeKalb Sycamore, 89.3 in Morris Joliet, 88.9 in Rockford area, Marengo, Harvard, and Beloit, and some of Wisconsin, covering much of central and northern Illinois, thanks to you. We're going to have a great show for you today. I'm here with my wife, Lynn. Before we start, I want to give a thanks to all of you out there who made our carathon a success. We're brought to you by you, as you well know, and with the carathon, you helped bring us to you again for another 6 months or so, so we're very, very grateful. I want to wish a happy Easter to everybody. Lynn and I were gone for the last 2 weeks, and we were off for Easter, and then John, after that carathon, our engineer, needed a weekend off, so we had another weekend off because of that, and so we're back here after 2 weeks. If there's anyone out there who still wants to make a late donation for the carathon, it's still not too late to do that. You can go ahead or just make a regular donation, as we always ask you to do and hope you'll do. And if you'd like to make a donation, and I hope you will, you can go to our website. That's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com, and you can make a donation there, and it will tell you much more about us as well. Or you can call us. Our number is 309-807-2427. Again, that's 309-807-2427. And we're going to talk a little bit more today about the myth of white Christian nationalism. And I use that word myth because it is a story, a narrative that is made up by our so-called friends on the left or the progressives, whichever term you want to use. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. I did talk about it a little bit before the carathon. Before that, I'm going to turn this over to my wife, Lynn, and see what she has to say before we start. So, Lynn, go ahead.
This is the day the Lord has made. Rejoice and be glad. He has risen. Hallelujah. Happy Eastertide to everyone. I'm glad you're here with us. And I want to thank you, everyone, for the support and prayers you have given for us. We really appreciate it. It's the only way the station can keep going is with your help. And would ask you to pray for peace. There's a lot of things going on in the Mideast, and we need pray. Well, Bob, you're going to talk about white Christian nationalism, exactly. Right?
Right.
Okay. What is Christian nationalism?
Okay, I'm going to explain that as we go along. That's a very, very good question, and that's one of the questions that has to be answered. Exactly what is it before we get into it? But we will get to that, and I'm going to read, Lynn, from an article in the May 2024 issue of First Things magazine, and the title of the article is The Myth of White Christian Nationalism. It's written by Kenneth L. Woodward, and he is the former religion editor of Newsweek, and so he goes into it, and I did talk about it a little bit, I think, on the last show before we left for Easter and for the carathon and for other things. So we'll take it from there, and it explains a little bit more about what so-called white Christian nationalism is supposed to be. And we'll see if we can go ahead and answer what that question is, Lynn, because it is very, very vague and iffy and ambiguous what it actually is from the point of view of the left. It's mostly, in my opinion, simply a term, a form of name-calling, and a term meant to somehow or another put down again people who do not agree with the progressive left. And that's basically, I think, what it is.
So it's another one of those made up for the moment kind of terms.
Exactly. And it does have sort of roots in a few books and articles by a certain particular person, and we'll get into that. But by and large, it's pretty ambiguous. So we'll start here with this article, The Myth of White Christian Nationalism. It says, in his first speech as Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, Mike Johnson sounded like a preacher in a pulpit. To quote him, he says, I believe that Scripture, the Bible, is very clear that God is the one who raises up those in authority, he began. He raised up each of you, all of us, and I believe that God has ordained and allowed each one of us to be brought here for this specific moment and this time. And so that's a statement from Mike Johnson, who is Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. And Woodward goes on in the article, and he says, it was the kind of public piety that folks in Johnson's Louisiana district like to hear from those they send to Congress. It was also inclusive of the Jews, Muslims, and non-believers in the chamber, but it wasn't interpreted that way. And of course, that's standard procedure. They were going to take, of course, the progressive left, whatever you want to call them, the liberals or whatever. They were going to take Johnson's speech as being negative no matter what. And so he probably should have known that no matter what he would say, how inclusive he would try to be, this is the way it was going to be taken by the progressives of our time. It goes on, he says, Woodward says, a chorus line of publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Time, and Salon, registered alarm. House Republicans had elected a white Christian nationalist to a post just two chairs removed from the presidency. And probably most people who heard that term, white Christian nationalist, had no idea what it even was, but nevertheless, from the very tone, they could tell that it had to be something bad. The money quote in the Times came from pollster Robert P. Jones, who labeled Johnson the embodiment of white Christian nationalism in a tailored suit, suggesting, not so subtly, that white Christian nationalists belong in white T-shirts and red MAGA hats. In other words, they were painting a particular picture of so-called white Christian nationalists, whatever they were. But if you were on the left or the Democratic progressive side, you knew that somehow or another white Christian nationalism had to be bad. And the person who was saying this was the person Robert P. Jones, and we'll get to that a little bit more. It goes on here, it says, and a number of academics, some of them raised in fundamentalist homes, have labored to locate white Christian nationalism within the wellsprings of the American character. In other words, this invention had to be located by them as somehow natural to certain members of the American character, as if somehow it had been here all along. Forecast among the latter is Jones. This is the guy who coined the term more than anybody else, who, in addition to being founder and former CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, writes books based in part on his surveys and spiced with slices of autobiography decrying the effects of white Christian supremacy. He has won the Grawemeyer Award, which in the past went to such eminent scholars as the theologian Jürgen Moltmann, and carries a $100,000 prize. The Brookings Institution, a respected left-of-center think tank, has partnered with Jones in identifying the white Christian nationalists among us. Jones's Baptist roots go generations deep in Southern soil, back to times when there were more Baptists in some towns than there were people, times when Southern Baptists rejected evangelical as a Yankee word. He declared himself for Jesus at the striking early age of 6. And as a teenager, he was often at his church 5 days a week. He graduated from a small Baptist college in Mississippi and then studied for the ministry at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Only there, he writes, did he learn that slavery was the main issue that had led to the creation of the Southern Baptist Convention. And not until he was a PhD student at Emory University did he learn the extent to which the church had endorsed Jim Crow and abetted the brutality inflicted on Southern blacks. The scales, he writes, fell from my eyes. Sounds like the epiphany that St. Paul had. Indeed, Jones's books can best be described as three variations on a line from Amazing Grace. Was blind, but now I see. In the End of White Christian America 2016, he heralded the cultural and demographic decline of white American Protestants, which was decade-old news at that time, and provided his own journalistic gloss on why and how it happened. The book's novelty is his invention of white Christian America as the social imaginary that illuminates 150 years of American history. So what Woodward here is saying is that Jones, in his simplicity, invented really white Christian nationalism, the term, and it's an imaginary explanation of 150 years of American history. As the title suggests, White Too Long is essentially a pulpit performance between the covers of a book. The subject is white supremacy as the linchpin of white Christian America, but also as the wind propelling the political ascendancy of Donald Trump. You might know all of this. This time, Jones widens his range to include glances at the tensions between black Catholics and white parishes. But the material he uses is old, derivative, and superficially sourced. Throughout all his books, Jones champions diversity and inclusion, but only of the familiar race and gender kind. He entirely overlooks a side of the American story that historians have long recognized, the significance of white ethnic minorities and of the trials of assimilation that immigrants from all over Europe experienced in the 19th century and the first half of the 20th. And he appears not to realize that the Catholic Church in this country was multicultural long before the most recent tide of Hispanic immigrants. So he's probably very, very short-sighted on the history of Catholicism, especially coming from such fundamental Baptist roots. But my fundamental problem, Woodward goes on, with Jones as a retailer of recent social history is that his basic narrative remains a simplistic and mostly regional story of oppressors and oppressed. I was a civil rights reporter, Woodward says, in the mid-1960s, and Jones knows nothing of how the movement disproportionately affected low-income ethnic whites in cities like Boston, Chicago, and Omaha. It was their neighborhoods that were to be integrated, not those of suburban white liberals. And that is a theme that we see all through progressivism. It seems to me, especially, that a lot of the white liberal progressives who propose all kinds of solutions and all kinds of various solutions to the problems of race in our country propose those solutions on other people than themselves, and usually in other neighborhoods other than their own. And usually all the detrimental effects are always piled on other people, and usually people who are least able to bear the burden, but certainly not any of themselves at all. And it seems that it's very nice to feel good about doing good when all the negative effects of the so-called doing good fall on somebody else besides yourself. And he goes on here, he says,
it was there. Before you do, I wanted to point out, too, look at the immigrants that are flowing across the border in the south and north of our country. And do they go to Chappaquiddick? Do they go to Bar Harbor, Maine, or any places where the elites are?
You certainly don't see them in Martha's Vineyard, do you?
No.
They didn't stay
they
there very long.
They got them out of there in a hurry.
They didn't stay there very long, did they?
No.
Exactly. And this is what Woodward is talking about here. He was a reporter, and he saw what happened back at that time. And he says, in other words, it wasn't the white liberal progressives whose neighborhoods and so forth were affected by all of their shenanigans and their policies. It was always somebody else's. It was their neighborhoods, the other people's neighborhoods, that were to be integrated, not those of suburban white liberals. It was their children, the children of the immigrants and so forth, who were to be bussed for the sake of school integration. Their homes that were subject to blockbusting by ruthless white realtors. Nowhere in Jones's book do we hear of the urban riots that devastated the inner cities of Newark, Detroit, and Los Angeles. Nor, for that matter, do we hear of the white Southern Baptist clergy, few in number to be sure, I met in Mississippi, who risked their lives to maintain pastoral links with black Baptist congregations. So it seems as if this Jones overlooks the courage and the leadership of his own people, of his own Baptist church, in fighting a wrongful segregation, and doesn't give credit where credit is due. In his most recent book, The Hidden Roots of the Supremacy of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future, Jones enlarges the category of the oppressed. And we will come back to that theme and talk about it a little bit more. And he enlarges the category of the oppressed to include indigenous Americans. He also enlarges the category of oppressors to include a couple of 15th century popes as believe it or not, oppressors that affected things going on today. So stay with us. We're going to talk about that, and we'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Catholic Spirit Radio's Carathon was a success. We reached our goal, and we still have donations arriving by mail and online. We thank all of our listeners and guests who participated and who made the event a fun and meaningful broadcast. Your generous donations show that you understand the importance and care about Catholic radio. You, dear listeners, truly put the care in Carathon.
Three Kings Gifts has sacramental and seasonal gifts, religious medals, rosaries, and more on the College Avenue Epiphany Church campus in Normal. Three Kings Gifts is open 10 to 3:30 on Thursday and Friday, 8 to 1 on Sunday. Profits help charitable organizations.
Listeners support Catholic Spirit Radio in many different ways. Some write checks, others use credit cards. But did you know that you can also give Catholic Spirit Radio your old car, truck, boat, motorcycle, or RV, even if it's not working? Donating your vehicle is easy. We take care of everything from pickup to tax receipt. Just go to CatholicSpiritRadio.com to click on the Donate Your Vehicle link or call 866-628-CARS.
If you have some extra time, put those hours to use for the Lord. With Catholic Spirit Radio's growing radio network, we have three new behind-the-scenes volunteer positions. If you're interested, call the station. 309-807-2427.
Volunteers are specifically needed for each of these roles. First, an energetic and experienced event manager is needed to coordinate our spring and fall on-air fundraisers.
Give us a call if that's you.
Second, Catholic Spirit Radio needs 1 to 2 hours every 2 or 3 weeks from a volunteer or a team of two for lightweight general cleaning at our Normal location.
Give us a call if you and a friend are interested.
And third, we are in need of 1 to 2 spirit liaisons from each of these areas, Rockford, Harvard, Morris, DeKalb, Sycamore, Lincoln, Pontiac, and Clinton. These individuals will assist with informational tables at your local events.
Give us a call if you can help out.
Become part of our radio mission in 2024.
Volunteer at Catholic Spirit Radio.
309-807-2427.
Hello, this is Steve Gleason with your 1 Minute Tool for Catholic Evangelism. Here's the question for your non-Catholic friend. Was the Catholic Church in existence as far back as the first 3 centuries? Well, here's your 3 best friendship tools for Catholic evangelism. Number 1, baseball. In September 1845, the New York Knickerbocker Baseball Club was formally established and called baseball. Rules were set, included a diamond-shaped infield, foul lines, and the 3-strike rule. But 7 years before that, in 1775, that game was already being played on schoolyards, well before it was ever called baseball. Secondly, the Apostolic Fathers, such as Tertullian Cyprian, Clement, St. Ignatius all wrote before 215 AD about the authority of the local bishop, and they used the name the Catholic Church, which already had the liturgy, the Eucharist, the readings, the relics, a hierarchy, and jurisdiction. And thirdly, my take. To fishermen, a dolphin was just a big fish until they were termed dolphins, but they were always dolphins. And baseball was baseball well before it was termed baseball. And you will love this. The early church was the Catholic Church well before Constantine the Great, the Nicene Creed, and your church history book.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. And we're talking about the myth of white Christian nationalism and an article written by Kenneth L. Woodward and appearing in First Things Magazine, the May issue of 2024 First Things Magazine, if you want to read that for yourselves. And we were talking about this man, Robert P. Jones, who has written books and started probably more than anybody else this whole idea of white Christian nationalism and some of the things he got wrong, especially about some of the race problems that we had back in the late 50s and early 60s and the neighborhoods and so forth that were ruined because of a lot of the various marches and other things and laws and so forth that were being passed at that time. And the burden that fell mostly on a lot of people who were, in effect, very recent immigrants to this country and working people who were bearing the burden of all of this, proposals by white Christian liberals, and talks here about the fact that Jones got this idea of white Christian nationalism, got the whole story wrong about what happened back at that time. And Jones also mentioned the fact that there were a couple of 15th century popes that somehow contributed to the racism that going on actually back at that time, and that Jones got wrong.
Yeah, I wish people that write about history would study what they're writing about.
Well, that's the problem. Some of these people are very simplistic, and they reduce everything to some kind of a simple solution that turns out mostly to be ambiguous, not very well filled out at all, and turns out to be simply a term that's thrown around and bandied about without any actual meaning to it except for use in name-calling. It goes on here, and Woodward says, Jones argues that in a series of decrees in the late 15th century, a few popes gave European rulers unequivocal theological and moral justification for exploiting lands and indigenous populations from Christopher Columbus forward. He claims that these decrees elevated what had been accepted practice into official church doctrine and international law. In other words, of course, there was discrimination, if you want to use that term, going on against Native peoples in the Americas back at the 15th century as exploration began from the 1400s and so forth on, began to go into the new lands. A lot of the Europeans were more powerful and stronger, and they went into various areas and exploited the Native peoples in those areas. But the church certainly didn't approve of this. And this kind of thing happens in all countries, by all peoples, everywhere. Stronger people often take advantage of weaker people. It certainly doesn't mean that it's right, and there weren't decent people or the church itself that ever justified doing this, and certainly never put that into some kind of official dogma or decree of their religion. And Woodward goes on to explain that. He says, Jones is glossing badly arguments advanced by some scholars of indigenous America, but none of the conclusions he draws are true. First, the decrees he cites never were church doctrine. They were the first in a series of specific directives to the Catholic crowns of Spain and Portugal, giving those nations the right to spread the faith and use it to civilize native populations. This was something that the church did in giving various rulers of various countries in Christendom the authority, the right, you know, giving their approval that it was okay to go ahead and to Christianize those peoples wherever possible. And the church had very specific rules about doing that. One of the specific rules that the church had was that nobody was to be brought into Christianity, and especially not into Catholicism, against their will. And was this always followed? Of course it wasn't. People don't always obey. The church didn't have some kind of an army that went around making people obey its decrees. In 1537, Pope Paul III replaced the old decrees with his own directives, recognizing the natural rights of the indigenous peoples, including their right to receive the faith freely and without coercion. Few explorers heeded the Pope's words. In other words, the church gave permission for various explorers who weren't necessarily theologians or priests or members of, you know, the clergy, or, you know, vocations, or had a vocation in the church. These people were acting as civilly, as, you know, the civil government. And the church gave them permission to go ahead, even though they were not members of the church clergy and so forth, to go ahead and Christianize people if they could. But when the church found out that this was being misused and misdirected against native peoples, by 1537, they even modified that decree and gave strict orders that people were not to be coerced into becoming Christian, and the people were not to be using Christianity as a means of taking advantage of indigenous peoples. In spite of the fact that the church made these declarations, very few explorers heeded the Pope's words on this. Of course, they were out, a lot of these people, for their own gain. And just because the church made decrees, it didn't necessarily mean that people obeyed them. It certainly wasn't the church's fault that people were doing this. It did what it could to correct things and to keep people from using what it had given permission to do irresponsibly. It goes on here. It says, Jones is fueled by moral indignation, which is admirable when warranted, but his work suffers under the evangelist's need to condemn and convert. So, with less intensity, do those social scientists and their amen corner in the media, who insist that white Christian nationalism is a fundamental threat to American society. And the question is it? Actually, the first question has to be, what is it? And we're coming to what you asked in the very beginning, Lynn. What is Christian nationalism?
Yeah. You can get very confused in all these terms. And they use the word Christian nationalism almost as an accusation, a not so polite accusation against Christians.
Exactly. And that's what this article gets on to say. It says white Christian nationalism is not something so much that people like ourselves or others take on. It's something that they're accused of being, you know,
exactly,
by other people.
Exactly.
And it says here, actually, the first question has to be, what is it? And the only reliable answer is, it depends on whom you ask. In other words, it's pretty variable and ambiguous. In their 2020 book, Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States, sociologist Samuel Perry and Andrew Whitehead offer this oft-repeated definition of white Christian nationalism. And they say, it is a cultural framework that blurs distinctions between Christian identity and American identity, viewing the two as closely related and seeking to enhance and preserve their union. Simple enough. But in their Time essay on Johnson's House election, Christian nationalism metastasizes from a theoretical concept to be tested into a litany of liberal moral sins. In other words, liberals take this very broad name and very broad concept of somehow or another white Christian nationalism being sort of a identification of basic Christianity and Americanism together all at the same time. They take this very, very broad idea and condense it into a litany of liberal mortal sins against the people that they're accusing of being Christian nationalists. Christian nationalists, the authors argued, are Americans who favor patriarchy, heterosexual marriage and pronatalism. And of course, pronatalism is being in favor of having large families and lots of babies, and also incorporated in there would be being against abortion. They also harbor a desire for strong leaders who, through the threat of violence or actual violence, defend the preferred social arrangements and hierarchies. And that would be Trump. So it comes down to it pretty much is a political concept to be used against people who you disagree with and who are in favor of the side of politics that you disagree with.
Yeah, just think of the image that comes in your mind when you hear about a Christian nationalist. Doesn't it kind of evoke those visions of, what do you call those?
Well,
that are the rebelling against the government.
It does, and it evokes to me actually in Jones's mind, I think, is somehow or another his rising above what he used to be in his own mind, and that is somehow some uneducated fundamentalist out to push his particular religion on everybody else, and now expanded and rising himself somehow above this and accusing everybody else of being what he used to be. And it goes on. It says, and of course, they are nearly always white and prone to racism. For Christian nationalists, the ideal American is generally understood to be a natural-born Anglo-Protestant. Most of this is actually a figment of Jones's imagination. And as I said, I think a lot of it is just simply his looking back at what he used to be and condemning it and thinking that he projecting that same thing onto lots of other people who haven't the slightest idea of agreeing with it in the first place. In The Flag and the Cross, Perry and Yale sociologist Philip Gorski provide a different, almost anthropological definition. There we learn that white Christian nationalists hold beliefs that reflect a desire to restore and privilege the myths, values, identity, and authority of a particular ethnocultural tribe. One could cite other definitions, other narratives, but the point is obvious. White Christian nationalism is a social construction, the meaning of which depends on who is doing the constructing. So
yeah, that's true.
Exactly. Even the term is questionable. I think what Whitehead, Perry, and Gorski are trying to capture is white Christian nativism, which at least has a traceable social history. And of course, white Christian nativism was probably more of an early, late 19th century and early 20th century reaction to a lot of immigrants coming over from Southern Europe and poor people from Ireland and other places who were very ill-educated, who had lived in dire poverty, emigrated to America because they simply had no other options where they were at. They were a lot of people virtually starving, if not actually starving. And they came here, and they were seen as a threat to the American civilization. But these people came over with the intention of doing the best that they could to try and to assimilate into our country, and they did a pretty good job of it in the long run. And
certainly did.
And there was a white native, reaction to this. And white, of course, was obviously because it was the people that were here already that were in power in charge of all the institutions. And there was a reaction to this influx of poor immigrants who were very uneducated and didn't speak English and, lived in poverty and a lot of times in disease and in very horrid conditions, and that reaction became known as, white Christian nativism. In other words, trying to hold on to what they had and seeing these immigrants coming in as a threat. And that's probably the closest thing you could get to what today is being called white Christian nationalism that probably doesn't really exist anymore. It goes on and says, how many Americans are white Christian nationalists? Again, it depends on whom you ask. White Christian nationalism is not an identity you can assert. It's an identity that's applied to you. And that's what we just mentioned, Lynn.
Yeah.
You can, however, audition for membership simply by assessing the following six statements, which provide the database for Whitehead and Perry's work. 1, the federal government should declare the United States a Christian nation. If you agree with that, that helps make you what people consider white Christian nationalists. But when people think that the United States should be a white Christian nation, they're looking back at its past, and basically that's what it was. Most people in this country were Christian, and most people do see nothing wrong with the Christian values, and we'll get to those in a little bit. 2, you advocate Christian values. And 3, enforce strict separation of church and state, and allow the display of religious symbols in public spaces, and allow prayer in public schools. None of these are shocking or somehow overwhelming. Most Christians believe that these things are good things. And once
isn't
these
that
things,
what we pay for in our taxes?
And once these things were common. In fact, it's Christian values and Christian virtues that actually created Western civilization in the first place and created and still create the basics of most of our law. It goes on, and it says, finally, you believe in the success of the United States as part of God's plan. And that if you're a Christian, that doesn't seem to me too much wrong in believing that at all, that the United States should be a Christian nation in the sense that it should incorporate the various Christian values, the good Christian values that make life good. And people that believe in that certainly aren't trying to...
They aren't malicious.
Yeah, they aren't doing it maliciously. That's a very good statement, Lynn. It goes, based on the responses to these statements, the authors calculated that 51.9% of Americans are either full or partial supporters of Christian nationalism. So most of our country would, answering these questions, be a Christian nationalist, because almost all of these things are not bad things. They're good things. You might disagree with one or two of them, but you'll probably agree with most. So we're going to talk more about that when we come back. We're going to take a break here, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio.
If you have some extra time, put those hours to use for the Lord. With Catholic Spirit Radio's growing radio network, we have 3 new behind-the-scenes volunteer positions. If you're interested, call the station. 309-807-2427.
Volunteers are specifically needed for each of these roles. First, an energetic and experienced event manager is needed to coordinate our spring and fall on-air fundraisers.
Give us a call if that's you.
Second, Catholic Spirit Radio needs 1 to 2 hours every 2 or 3 weeks from a volunteer or a team of 2 for lightweight general cleaning at our normal location.
Give us a call if you and a friend are interested.
And third, we are in need of 1 to 2 spirit liaisons from each of these areas: Rockford, Harvard, Morris, DeKalb, Sycamore, Lincoln, Pontiac, and Clinton. These individuals will assist with informational tables at your local events.
Give us a call if you can help out.
Become part of our radio mission in 2024.
Volunteer at Catholic Spirit Radio.
309-807-2427.
Listeners support Catholic Spirit Radio in many different ways. Some write checks, others use credit cards. But did you know that you can also give Catholic Spirit Radio your old car, truck, boat, motorcycle, or RV, even if it's not working? Donating your vehicle is easy. We take care of everything from pickup to tax receipt. Just go to CatholicSpiritRadio.com to click on the Donate Your Vehicle link, or call 866-628-CARS.
Three Kings Gifts has sacramental and seasonal gifts, religious medals, rosaries, and more on the College Avenue Epiphany Church campus in Normal. Three Kings Gifts is open 10 to 3:30 on Thursday and Friday, 8 to 1 on Sunday. Profits help charitable organizations.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break, and we're talking about white Christian nationalism, and we're reading from an article in the First Things magazine for May 2024. And the title of that article is The Myth of White Christian Nationalism. And it's written by Kenneth L. Woodward, a former religion editor at Newsweek magazine. And it's talking about the ambiguousness and the impreciseness of the term white Christian nationalism and how it came about. And it goes on here, it says, as I mentioned, if you respond to the statements of researchers about what white Christian nationalism really is, it would be most of those things that our nation took for granted for a long, long time as basically a nation founded by people who were mostly Christian. It says, and it went on to say, based on responses to those statements, the authors calculated that 51.9%, let's just say 52% of Americans, are either full or partial supporters of Christian nationalism, and why not? Most of the things mentioned here are things that are good things. It goes on, it says, for example, believing that the government should promote Christian values like justice, honesty, truthfulness, and charity, virtues shared by people of other faiths and people of no faith, hardly makes a respondent a nationalist or even a Christian. In other words, you can believe in these values, you can believe in these virtues, and you don't really even have to be a Christian, because actually this is what Christianity did give to the world, and most people accept these, whether they're Christians or not. And those values, again, are justice, honesty, truthfulness, charity. All of these things are considered virtues, and I would hope that people on the left, the people who are making these accusations, still consider them virtues. If they don't, then that's even a greater charge against them. And what is the meaning of strict separation of church and state? How can any of these questions support what the authors see as an implicit theocratic threat to the country? In other words, the author is acting. How can these things support any kind of a threat to this country? If people adopted all these values tomorrow, and if everybody did, we would be a better country for it.
And right, but you can see, right, as this goes along, just how these ideas are formulated in these sayings go, and how you can turn people around, can't you? Did you manipulate people and how they think by coming up with these slogans?
Yeah. Exactly. That's a perfect, exact statement of what they're doing. In other words, it's a means of name calling and a means of manipulating people. It's a means that the left always uses, the progressive always use, is to throw out accusations and then get somebody on the defensive and have people spending all kinds of time trying to defend themselves against something that doesn't really have any meaning, something that's totally ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like Woodward said, he says, but if you find, as a number of social scientists have, that the statements are too ambiguous to yield precise interpretations, you may doubt, as I do, that the responses tell us anything reliable about what Christian nationalism is or how it might explain political and social behavior, because it doesn't. It doesn't explain anything the way these people use it. In fact, actually, most people would probably be proud to say that they are a white Christian nationalist if they actually go by what really white Christian nationalism would incorporate, and that is simply the values and teachings and principles of general Christianity, which are good principles, which actually our laws and so forth are still based on, as I said before. And it goes on, it says here, but as with their survey, the point was to ferret out Christian nationalists and pin the label on them. You know, whatever that means, again, ferret out Christian nationalists. In other words, to find people who will respond to accusations such as this, get them on the defensive, and then pin some kind of a label on them that is really pretty much meaningless, except for the fact that it identifies what America pretty much has always been. He goes on here. He says, yes, those who take religion seriously, that is, those who exhibit high levels of religious belonging, behavior, and belief, tend to vote Republican, but they make up only about 17% of the population, according to various studies. They are far less numerous than the 28% who, according to political scientist David Campbell and his colleagues, identify as secularists, meaning people who are not simply non-religious, but adamant and active in opposing the presence of religion in the public square, and we have more and more of that today. The secularists alone outnumber by almost 3-to-1 the 10% or so who have been labeled white Christian nationalists, and they overwhelmingly vote for Democrats. So there is a divide in America between peoples, but the divide really is between people who basically believe in the decent and civilizing values of Christianity, which after all built Western civilization, the good part of Western civilization, and again, our values such as truthfulness, equality before the law, charity, love of neighbor, honesty, fair dealing, all of the good virtues that people want to believe in, and people who see that these virtues and these values are being destroyed in our country, and they're being destroyed mostly by people who are doing the accusing of these very virtues as somehow being bad. And again, that's something that we pointed out in other shows, and I want people out there to remember, we as Christians, and especially we as Catholics, should start building a resistance to all of this stuff. And the fact that the very virtues that built our country and built Western civilization are being torn down, that these virtues are Christian virtues and they're good virtues. And if they're misused by some people, the majority of Christians certainly are not misusing them. And the attacks of the left and the secularists seem to be nothing mostly but name-calling, and a pretty poor job of name-calling at that.
That's because our leaders and representatives and senators and congressmen and everybody else are setting the example. What do we get from the political parties? They call each other names, and they don't get anything done.
That certainly does seem...
Except sell us down the drain.
It certainly does seem to be the case, and the fact is that what we have on the side of people who are doing this accusing is a refusal to recognize a lot of the tremendous harm that has been done by their crusades in the past. The harm done to people's neighborhoods, harm done to people themselves, harm done to the country, experiments and so forth that don't work, the destruction of our educational system, the destruction of marriage, the destruction of the family, the abortion plague and the abortion problem that we have going on in our country, the idea of the fact that there is not the glue, the Christian glue and the virtues and so forth that held us together as a nation, the inability to have a common religion and a common belief anymore, and the common values that are, come from that, and this constant divide, and almost all of the experiments that have been tried out in our school systems and our country itself, haven't worked, and there's problems in our country where we're worse off than before, and even now our economic system is being very, very much destroyed by a lot of these projects and a lot of this idea of self-righteousness is going on among the people that are calling other people names, especially using broad swaths to paint and tar everyone with the brush of so-called white Christian nationalism. He goes on here and he says, despite the vagueness of the term white Christian nationalism and the difficulty of identifying its adherents, we are certain to hear a great deal more about the threat it poses to American democracy as the election cycle turns on. And this is another thing that makes me, laugh, the threat that it poses to our democracy.
We're not supposed to have a democracy in the first place, were we?
No, actually, we were supposed to have a republic, but again, all republics degenerate into democracies, at least the republics that are as large as the United States are almost bound to degenerate into a democracy. But actually, if you want to put the finger on people who are trying to destroy democracy, it seems that the name callers are the ones that are doing the most of the destroying. In a democratic country, we want various peoples to be able to run for office, and it seems like unless people agree with those on the left, the conclusion by the left is that nobody except people like themselves deserve even to run for office, that only they and they alone know what's good for the country, even though if we take a look at it, that our country actually, in my opinion, is declining in its ability to operate on a decent and virtuous basis. It goes on finally, and the article concludes, it says, in the rancid state of American politics, and that's a very good word, rancid, and in our state of politics is rancid, voters are moved more by fear and loathing of the other party than by commitment to their own. But what will we hear of the secularists, who are more numerous, wealthier, and more politically active than those who have been labeled white Christian nationalists? What we will hear is the sound of silence. In other words, on the other side, we don't seem to hear anything very positive about the country or any really positive solutions, except the name calling and the attack that is constantly going on. And finally, my conclusion is that if you look at the whole thing and really get down to what's the definition of a so-called white Christian nationalist, the definition is actually a pretty good one. I certainly wouldn't be ashamed to be called a white Christian nationalist, and I don't think anybody else should either, if you go by the fact that white Christian nationalism simply incorporates the ordinary virtues and principles of Christianity that built Western civilization and built those things in our country that are good. And of course, there are a lot of bad things that are not good and have been in the past, but every country suffers from those kind of things. And if anything, it is the Christian virtues that will help overcome those things, not contribute to them. So any more that you have to say on that, Lynn?
No, I think I've said enough.
Me myself. I didn't mean for this particular topic to take up the whole show today, but evidently it does, and we'll get to some of the other topics that I wanted to talk about later. But
I think, you know, it's a good job bringing to the people that are listening, and a warning to beware of all these slogans they come up with. And think about where they came from, where they originated from, and why. They're certainly not to help the ordinary people out, are they?
Exactly. And the fact is that if you're being called a white Christian nationalism and being called any names when you're being name called, is don't spend your time trying to defend yourself against very ambiguous, you know, and amorphous charges that you can't even put your finger on. And for the most part, what right so-called white Christian nationalism really is simply, I think also the word in there is white, is simply an attack on people for somehow or another that you're guilty of being white.
And especially those old white guys in Washington.
And the fact is that at one time there was an attack on people for having a dark-colored skin. Now there's an attack on people for having a white-colored skin. None of these things are hold any water. And other than a few things, I disagree if white Christian nationalism incorporated the idea of a total separation of church and state. I would disagree with that part of it. I think that there's a distinction between the church and state, as I've said before, but there's not a separation. That every single society has to have a religion that it's based on, whether that religion is Christianity, which I hope it would be, or whether it's simply white secular, I shouldn't say white, but should be just simply pure secular humanism, the idea of materialism and the idea of somehow or another the people by themselves without any values that are transcendent or outside of themselves can build some kind of a utopian civilization. I think that is a false premise. And it has led to nothing but disaster after disaster, and that secularism is as much of a religion as Christianity is, only to me it's a negative religion. It's something that you look in a mirror and it's the opposite of the virtues of Christianity, and it's the opposite of the positive construction that Christianity has built. So if somebody calls you a white Christian nationalist, for the most part, you can say, fine, I certainly am one. I believe in all of the Christian virtues, charity, love of neighbor, and peace and truthfulness, justice, mercy, all of those things. There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with them at all. They built Western civilization, And if Western civilization has gone wrong, it certainly hasn't been because of those things. And so at any rate, we're going to have to stop here, and we'll take up a few other issues next week and or the week after. It may be that we may not be able to be here again next week.
Oh, that's right. We have a funeral.
We have a commitment to make. We have a funeral that we are going to attend, and so we probably won't be here next week. But we'll be here the week after, and we will talk about some of those issues then. So in the meantime, Saint Michael, the archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And prince of the heavenly host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits, who wanders to the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio.